I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a very consequential American in the history of our country, and particularly the history of the 19th century, as someone who kind of bridges the gap between the American Revolution and founding period and westward expansion and all the other important events that happened in the course of our country's history in the first half of the 19th century. And that person, of course, is John Quincy Adams. And particularly this conversation about John Quincy Adams has been brought on by the release of a new edition of his writings by the Library of America. And we want to talk about that work. I want to talk about the life, legacy, and thought of John Quincy Adams. And for that conversation, we're joined today by Michael Lucchese. Michael is Associate Editor of Law and Liberty, a well-known online publication and book review. He's also a contributing editor to Providence and founder of Pipe Creek Consulting. And I think you also hold the title of Director of Mentorship, is that right, for the Hudson Institute?
Yeah, the Hudson Institute Political Studies Program. That's right.
Very good. So this is a person who is, I'll use an old-fashioned term. Michael is a man of letters. And what better person to talk with than about another great man of letters, John Quincy Adams. Michael, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you so much for having me on.
John Quincy Adams, why is it a good time for us now to refamiliarize ourselves with him and his writings?
So union was one of the great themes of John Quincy Adams's life. He was there at the creation of the union, and at the end of his life, he began to see the fraying of the union. And I think we're going through some things where we're thinking about the American Union. What does it mean? What is our Constitution? There's a sort of spirit of moral ferment, I think, on both the right and the left in America today. And I think John Quincy Adams really experienced a lot of that, thought a lot deeply about the meaning of these questions. And I think that he can guide us through many of those questions today.
Our listeners, as you know, are pretty historically informed, and I'm sure we've all heard of John Quincy Adams, but we may not know the full span of his amazing career in public life and public service. Just remind us about who John Quincy Adams was and his long career.
Yeah, so John Quincy Adams was the oldest son of John Adams, the revolutionary hero and American founder and second president. He would go on to a career in politics of his own. He served in a variety of diplomatic positions throughout the 1790s in the Washington administration. He was a lawyer. He taught rhetoric at Harvard University. And then he goes on to have a political career. He's elected to the United States Senate. He becomes Secretary of State and eventually president. But strangely enough, after his one-term presidency, which was not very successful, he went back into politics and was a representative from Massachusetts in the House of Representatives. And he became sort of a leader of the anti-slavery movement. So he had a long life. He saw the revolution. He traveled with his father to Europe. He participated in the rough and tumble politics of the early republic. And then he really was one of the leading statesmen in the years approaching the Civil War.
One of the things that you note in your review of this new release of his writings is that few presidents thought more carefully about their words than John Quincy Adams. And as you just noted, he was a professor of rhetoric, someone who studied words. What was his education like? How did he come to have such a deep knowledge and appreciation for the spoken and written word?
Yeah, so John and Abigail Adams were devoted to their children's education, and particularly John Quincy. He was multilingual. He learned French. He learned Spanish. He tried to learn Russian, although he was not very successful at that. He learned Latin and Greek. He was really he traveled with his father to Europe in part so that his father could educate him. There's a great drawing I came across doing some research in one of his diaries. He was sailing past Elsinore Castle on the coastline of Denmark to get to Russia for a diplomatic position, and he just drew a sketch of it and said, "This is where Hamlet took place." So that's sort of the classical world in which he lived, right? It was a really Renaissance education, the peak of the Enlightenment in a lot of ways. And then he, of course, goes to Harvard University. He is educated there, and he gets a kind of education too, I think, by watching his father's political career. There were some successes that his father experienced: the Declaration of Independence, negotiating the Treaty of Paris, and of course becoming president. But there are other ways in which his father was kind of a failure, and he reflected on those ways, and he tried to manage his own political career differently. I think this is actually what makes him partly such an interesting figure to study, is you can really follow his education by following his sort of public writing and see how he comports himself differently as a young man as opposed to an old man and everything in between.
Talk a little bit about the growth of John Quincy Adams, the changes that you see, because thinking about again the Library of America edition does such a great job in our outlining major documents and supporting material that really show us his philosophy, his political philosophy. And you interestingly labeled it revolutionary conservatism. That seems like an oxymoron.
Yeah, so obviously he's trying to conserve the American Revolution, which is sort of a strange way of thinking about it. How can a conservative preserve something revolutionary? And I think the conservatism part comes in really as a reaction against the French Revolution. His first major sort of a public statement, which is included in this collection, it's called the Letters from Publicola. They were a series of anonymous letters published in a Boston newspaper at the start of the 1790s, defending Edmund Burke's attack on the French Revolution. Thomas Jefferson brought out an issue of Thomas Paine's pamphlet, The Rights of Man, in the United States, and the Adamses sort of freaked out about this. And John Quincy Adams writes this savage critique of Thomas Paine, of Thomas Jefferson, the French Revolution, and he positions himself on Edmund Burke's side. Originally, they were anonymously published, so nobody knew it was him. And Jefferson actually suspects that John Adams himself wrote it. And this is one of the things that leads to the fraying of their own relationship. But eventually, it comes out that John Quincy Adams wrote it. And George Washington was so impressed by these pamphlets that he appointed John Quincy Adams, ambassador to Holland as a sort of reward for this. Paine attacks Washington's character in The Rights of Man. And I think that really, so he really sees a fundamental difference between the French Revolution and the American Revolution. The French Revolution is a rejection of the Western heritage. It's a rejection of the Western conception of the dignity of man, whereas the American Revolution is a sort of flowering of the classical heritage. And that's not how every American thought about these differences. Obviously, this was a very controversial position, in some ways, I think this actually contributes to Adams's unpopularity later down the line. But it is how Adams thought about it, and I think it's a very good way to think about it too, stressing the continuity and not the break with the broader tradition.
So when John Quincy Adams is thinking about the French Revolution and critiquing it as a break from the Western tradition, that's the conservative part, I guess one might say. What's the revolutionary part of his thought?
So Adams was extremely dedicated in ways that somebody like, say, Edmund Burke was not necessarily dedicated to the equality of man, both in the sense of a sort of universal moral equality, but also in another sense that men should be politically equal, right? He was a Republican. He was not a monarchist. He was not a reactionary. He was a Republican who believed in that kind of equality of citizenship. And he frequently cites the Declaration of Independence itself as his sort of guide star. There's a famous speech he gives in 1821 when he's Secretary of State. And he holds up the original copy of the Declaration of Independence in the Capitol building. And he says, he proclaims that this is the only lawful ground on which governments might be formed, government by consenting equals, right? So there is something revolutionary about this. And he was a supporter of movements in Europe to reform. Although in that same speech, that's the famous speech in which he says, "We go not abroad in search of monsters to destroy." So there are limits, and he's very aware of the limits of revolution and the limits of revolutionary possibility. But he also does have this very high view of man, that we can be equals, not in the sense that the French revolutionaries meant we're all sort of lowered to one level, but where we all set our sights on a higher level, and it's the heights that make us equal, not the depths that make us equal to Adams, at least.
So how do we see, that's very interesting, because you make the case in your review, and certainly the collection seems to suggest that John Quincy Adams was unusual among American politicians, even perhaps of the Revolutionary or early Republican period, because he really took those ideas so seriously. And they remain a kind of lodestar for him, as you say, all the way through his career, including his time as an abolitionist in Congress. How do we see, starting from his earlier periods, that revolutionary conservative philosophy actually at work in the issues that he deals with?
Yeah, so at the beginning of his career, he identified with the Federalist Party. That was his father's party, and they're sort of the right flank of American politics. Some have called them counter-revolutionaries, and especially in Massachusetts, where they were led by Fisher Ames, they have this sort of religious sectarian spirit. We might call them a species of religious nationalist, perhaps. But John Quincy Adams was never entirely comfortable with the full extent of their counter-revolutionary spirit, especially as the War of 1812 approaches and Britain is pursuing policies such as impressment that are infringing on America's rights to a free sea. He becomes more and more uncomfortable with the way that they think about Britain, the way that they think about America's relationship with Britain, and he wants to break. Now, he's never a Jeffersonian. I think this is something of a misperception that some people, scholars of the era, promote. He was never really a Jeffersonian. He admired Thomas Jefferson in some ways, but he was always much harsher on his character than his father was. And he really doesn't have much truck with James Madison, for instance. He was not a great admirer of him as a statesman. But he sort of turns from this reactionary junta in Massachusetts and becomes more independent. He winds up, after Ames dies, a very pessimistic essay Ames wrote, "The Danger of American Liberty," is published, and it's brutally, brutally critical of the American people. Basically, Ames's thesis is the American people are not fit for liberty. And Adams writes a response, "American Principles." It's a great pamphlet that is unfortunately not included in this collection. But "American Principles" it's his response to this counter-revolutionary fervor. And he essentially says that it's sectarian. It is not an honest appreciation of the American people or who they are. And that this is a complete misunderstanding of the revolution and the republic. So it sort of puts him in this strange middle ground where he's not revolutionary the way that the Jeffersonians are, but he's not a high Federalist either. He's something all on his own. And so he kind of flits between parties at different times. And some people accuse him, because he goes back and forth between the parties, which were, you know, much weaker in a certain sense in their day than our day. The people accuse him of inconsistency, but I actually think that the switching is because he was being consistent and because he was a consistent adherent of this revolutionary conservatism we've been talking about.
So that's very interesting to me, because obviously after his father loses in the election of 1800, the Jeffersonians take over And there's an era of sort of unbroken Democratic-Republican ascendance. And if you're a person like John Quincy Adams and you're going to be involved in public life, you somehow have to navigate that. You have to adjust yourself to the new reality that the Federalist Party is essentially now a rump party of New England and really can't win or has very difficult time winning national elections. How does John Quincy Adams bring that mindset to bear in having to deal with Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe ascendant?
Yeah. So at the beginning of that period, he was in the United States Senate. I believe it's 1803, although that might not be entirely correct. But in the early days of Jefferson's administration, he becomes the United States Senator. And he is part of the opposition party. It's kind of loyal opposition. He dines at the White House with Jefferson on occasion. But he's always very, very critical of Jefferson as a president. But later, as the Federalist Party sort of spins down into this reactionary backwater, John Quincy Adams chooses consciously, and we have his diary entries where he talks about these choices that he's making. He chooses to, instead of focusing on these partisan issues, these factional issues, he's going to try to focus on things that are of concern to the entire union. And that's always how he talks about it in terms of the union, right? He wants Southerners and Northerners. He wants Massachusetts men and Virginians. He wants Federalists and Democratic Republicans to get along and to work for a sense of the common good. And along with this shift in his way of thinking about politics, he also starts focusing on a different set of issues, namely foreign policy. And he comes to see foreign policy as the space where you really can do good for the union without getting mired in the partisan muck.
And what's his basic disposition when he's involved in foreign policy? Obviously, he later becomes in the executive branch engaged in foreign policy. What's his basic outlook on American foreign policy?
Yeah, so this is another area in which I think there are a lot of misconceptions. A lot of latter-day isolationist organizations, the John Quincy Adams Institute, for instance, the Quincy Institute, for instance, they will take him on as a sort of patron saint because that 1821 speech that we were talking about. But I don't think that he was an isolationist. I think that he was a realist, to be sure. He was very realistic about the limits of power, and he didn't think that America should be some sort of humanitarian democracy that would go around the world forcibly revolutionizing regimes or anything like that. But he was somebody who wanted an active America on the global stage. He wanted America to be a global player, and he wanted America to tip the balance of the scales toward freedom. So he provides all sorts of diplomatic support to revolutionary groups in Europe, in the sort of emergence of liberal nationalism. He's very enthusiastic about the Greek Revolution, for instance, and later. He's very devoted to independence for the South American republics, and he works very closely, in fact, with colleagues in the British Empire, George Canning especially, to sort of work out a way to get the old colonial powers, out, especially Spain, out of South America and to liberate those countries. And that's not to say, again, that he was the kind of person who wanted to revolutionize every single regime. He wasn't some kind of proto-neoconservative or neoliberal or anything like that. But he did see the American founding as having a universal significance that trickled down to practical politics, including foreign policy.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
How about when he becomes president? That's a really an amazing moment. His father, John Adams, is still alive. So he gets to see his son become president. Again, another amazing historical moment. How does John Quincy Adams become president, and what's his presidency like?
Well, so infamously, he becomes president as part of the corrupt bargain. It was a three-way presidential race between Adams, Henry Clay, and Andrew Jackson, the first populist. Clay and Adams sort of join forces to beat back populism. John Quincy Adams comes into the presidency with all of these big ideas, these big plans, internal improvements, a new system of trade. He has all these plans for supporting certain revolutionary groups around the world in foreign policy. He just is not a popular president. He's not beloved by the people. He doesn't really speak the language of the people, not in the way that Andrew Jackson did, of course. The character from Shakespeare, I think he can kind of be compared to as president, is actually Coriolanus, who sort of turns his back on the American people in some ways. And he's very, very disappointed in them for not seeing his vision, not understanding his ideas about moral progress. The slavery issue starts troubling him greatly at this time. Russell Kirk in The Conservative Mind talks a lot about his sort of disappointment as president. It is a disappointing moment in his life. It's stressful for him. He doesn't really like being president of the United States, but he feels like it's really important to prevent this dark force that he considers Andrew Jackson to be, to prevent him from dominating American politics. And then the 1828 election happens, of course, and Jackson blows him out of the water. And he has to sort of retreat from politics for a time.
Let's talk about that. You mentioned his deep disdain, distrust, and maybe even stronger than that for Andrew Jackson and the movement that he saw Andrew Jackson creating and leading. What was his criticism of Jackson and Jacksonianism?
Yeah, so essentially, there are sort of two elements of the criticism. One is this sort of theoretical element, I think. I think he truly does see in Jackson a kind of Jacobinism. He sees a revolutionary fervor in this populist movement that he thinks could undo the good of the American Revolution. And then the other danger that Adams sees is this kind of low, vulgar, interest-based politics. He didn't think that politics should be conducted on the basis of interest groups or giving bounties or things to supporters or the spoils system, right? So there are these two dangers, right? This danger of ideology and this danger of vulgarization, and he's terrified of them both. He thinks that they're very bad news for the American Republic, especially as chattel slavery becomes a more and more pressing issue, something that's very liable to be exploited by either ideologues or vulgar demagogues.
As after he's blown out in 1828, as you put it, and the Jacksonian democracy seems triumphant, right? Politically, socially, in every way, really, in the country. What happens to John Quincy Adams? What does he do?
So he retreats from politics for a time. He writes things. He actually writes a little bit of Shakespeare criticism, which is quite good. I recommend it. He eventually is so motivated by the problem of slavery. He really hates slavery as an institution. He's always hated it. He's never quite known what to do about it. But as it becomes more and more at the forefront of American politics, JQA says, well, now is my time. I'm going to stand up and I'm going to fight the good fight for this cause. Lincoln later says that the Union has a philosophical cause that is contained within the Declaration of Independence. And I think John Quincy Adams believed that too. And so he runs for the House of Representatives, a very democratic thing to do in some ways. And I actually would argue, and I think other Adams historians would argue this as well, that he was more successful as a member of the House of Representatives than as president of the United States. He's a more effective parliamentarian in some ways than executive. And he becomes one of the leaders of the anti-slavery crusade. Although I would crucially make a distinction between Adams's anti-slavery position and the more radical position that the abolitionists take. And Adams, he was never terribly hostile to the abolitionists or anything like that, but he did find them a bit ridiculous, and he didn't think that they would guide the anti-slavery movement in quite the way that he wanted it to go. So that's also a part of what he's doing. He's trying simultaneously to fight this moral crusade while also mitigating against the danger of disunion and political extremism.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because in the 1830s, obviously, we see the rise of people like William Lloyd Garrison, very radical abolitionist, and the larger American anti-slavery society and the larger movement against abolitionism, against slavery takes off among the abolitionists. It seems like all of those abolitionists claim the Declaration of Independence as a source of moral, sort of a moral anchor of the Republic against slavery. But they are really deeply split, as you know, on the question of the Constitution. And is the Constitution a pro-slavery document or an anti-slavery document? Where does John Quincy Adams fit in his thinking about the Constitution and the American founding and the issue of slavery?
So I don't know if he ever wrote anything. He may have. I'm just not familiar with it. If he ever wrote anything on that particular question, is the Constitution a pro or an anti-slavery document? What I do think he believed was that the American founding was an anti-slavery moment. The ideas, the principles of the founding, they push back against this noxious institution. So I think that he saw the founder's vision, especially somebody like George Washington, who was one of the great figures he idolized his entire life. He saw George Washington and his calls for the gradual emancipation of enslaved people. And I think that is really sort of where he comes down on. Reading this collection of writings specifically, what I became very convinced by was, in many ways, I think John Quincy Adams is the predecessor to Abraham Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln's unique position in all of this. Lincoln actually serves as a pallbearer at John Quincy Adams's congressional funeral, not the funeral back in Massachusetts, but the memorial service held at the U.S. Capitol building. I don't know if they knew each other very well. We don't have any letters from John Quincy Adams talking about Abraham Lincoln. They served in the House of Representatives together, of course. I think that Lincoln's particular philosophic approach to politics resembles a great deal John Quincy Adams. And that's, I think, another reason why John Quincy Adams deserves to rank in the first tier of American statesmen.
What are some of the ways? That's fascinating. And you think about the Library of America collection, and it's the material it includes on his time in Congress and his anti-slavery principles. What are some of the ways that John Quincy Adams brought those principles to bear practically in fighting slavery? I mean, some of our listeners no doubt have seen perhaps the movie Amistad, for example. How does he actually try to fight against the institution?
So Amistad the Amistad case is a great example. A group of enslaved people are on a ship. It's wrecked. They come to the United States. The question is, are they enslaved or are they not enslaved? And it's this sort of pitched legal battle. And Adams defends the enslaved people and argues for their freedom and eventually wins the case. They give him a Bible, which he treasures to the end of his life. You can still see it if you go to the Adams National Historical site in Quincy, Massachusetts. So really, I think that's kind of the role that he takes on. The nickname he gets when he's in Congress is old man eloquent, which I love. And he sort of becomes the primary spokesman for a sober anti-slavery politics. While people like William Lloyd Garrison are burning copies of the Constitution on Boston Commons because they say it's a deal with the devil, with the slaveholders, John Quincy Adams is saying, no, we need to understand there is a harmony between the Declaration and the Constitution, and a constitutional politics can lead to the end of slavery eventually. So really that's kind of the role that he takes on. He's an elder statesman leading the charge rhetorically against this institution. He also does a little bit of outreach to Southerners, because unlike some of those Massachusetts abolitionists, he was a Union man first and foremost. And so he saw the Union as the engine that could end slavery, and adherence to the Union as what could bring about the end of that horrible institution. And of course, you know, the Civil War was terrible, and hundreds of thousands of men died. But ultimately, by upholding the Union, we were able to preserve American liberty and defeat American slavery. And I think that's really one of the great lessons of John Quincy Adams's later political career.
One of the things you also talk about in your review, however, is that there were some weaknesses to his philosophy of revolutionary conservatism and also to his own particular approach to politics and to public life. What were some of those weaknesses?
Yeah, so the word elitist comes to mind when we think about any of the Adamses, right? He sort of sees himself as you know, I've been to France, I've been to Europe, I've seen these things, I have this wide view of the world, and therefore I know what is best. And sometimes I think that can be expressed in an admirable way, but in other ways, he actually comes off really snobby. He's sort of disdainful of ordinary Americans in some letters that he writes. And so I think that he has this strange aristocratic view of politics that made him ill-suited for the politics of the early republic, and especially ill-suited for the post-Jacksonian world. So that's I think one problem. I think another problem is a problem that you get a lot when intellectuals run for public life and serve in that capacity. Which is he was very much in his own head. His diaries are really beautiful. Library of America publishes an edition of them as well. They're really beautiful and teach us a lot about the time. But also there's this just sort of constant agonizing. It's very much like Hamlet, and it's kind of infuriating in some ways, right? So I think that. While I admire him, and again, I think he ranks in the first tier of great American statesmen, I do think that there were a lot of flaws with his approach. And I think those of us who are defenders of the American founding, like John Quincy Adams were, I think we can learn something from the ways in which maybe his politics didn't resonate with the American people.
What do we see? That's fascinating. Your mention of his diary and the wonderful edition that the Library of America does put out. What do we see in that diary? What's the glimpse of the man, John Quincy Adams?
So one thing that I've been struck by whenever I flip through is the amount of classical allusions. He's sort of constantly writing one third in English, one third in Greek, one third in Latin, right?
Yeah, that's not typical of the time or even of today, for sure.
No. But it's not that these classics were academic interests of his. They were that. But on a deeper level, he sees himself in those classics. And he's quoting these thoughts almost as though they are his own thoughts, right? He's sort of thinking through these books. And I think that's something he learned from his father, who also studied books that way. I think it's a really beautiful way to engage with the world, to be clear. I also think that it can be a little bit silly and melodramatic at times. But I think that really explains John Quincy Adams was. In some ways, he was more an antique Roman than a modern American.
One of the things we also find from the collection is, And I think we see it in the diary, too, is his, I'll call it particular religious beliefs. For example, Andrew Jackson runs as a Trinitarian Christian, whether or not he practiced Christianity so faithfully, but he certainly ran that way publicly in the 1820s and 30s. What about John Quincy Adams' religious beliefs and their influence on his thought and his life?
So John Adams's his father's religious beliefs are fairly straightforward. He was a kind of typical Enlightenment Unitarian, right? A Congregationalist. He really believed in the value of religion as a sort of social utility, and he believed in a providential God, but he didn't get much more specific than that. John Quincy Adams, on the other hand, is far more interested in a living way in religion. He really wants to understand who is God, what is faith, and how should I live because of my answers to those questions. And so he actually undergoes a lot of religious change throughout his life. Partly in reaction to the French Revolution, he becomes a sort of Trinitarian Anglican kind of thing. It's not exactly right, and it's not entirely orthodox. And he and his father write letters back and forth where they're sort of talking about this. His father dismisses this new faith as monkish superstition, which is a phrase I love. But John Quincy Adams never really has a terribly settled religious life. These are always questions in a ferment, right? Sometimes he's Unitarian and sometimes he's a Trinitarian. It's kind of difficult to figure out exactly what he meant. And I think that also explains why somebody like Andrew Jackson, who uses religion in a certain way, is able to appeal to the people in a way that John Quincy Adams is not, who, even though he is a religious man and speaks in religious terms and religious categories very frequently, it's not this kind of religious nationalist appeal to faith, right? It doesn't see, and I think this is true of his views of concept American exceptionalism more generally. He doesn't really see it as an excuse to violate principles, but rather as a kind of burden to uphold them. So there's this ponderous quality to his religious life that I think is both very impressive and also maybe not exactly what you want in a statesman.
Having looked at this amazing collection and, of course, your own study of John Quincy Adams, maybe this is an unfair question, but he is well known, as you say, Old Man Eloquent, for example, and he has that reputation. And we see the movie Amistad, and he seems like such a serious human being with a very kind of noble bearing, almost Coriolanus-like, as you say. But what to you is the most surprising thing about John Quincy Adams that you've encountered?
I think the most surprising thing about John Quincy Adams that I've encountered has to be, I think it really has to be that agonizing quality, the way that he feels so deeply. There's a kind of romanticism to it. And it's not something that I think is well understood. I don't think that it's something we necessarily can understand exactly. But I do think that there's almost this existentialist quality to especially the diaries, right? And for me personally, as I've been studying Adams and I've been reading his diaries and writing about him, I think that it's really helped me understand that the worlds of theory and practice, the world of life and the mind, the mind and the heart, these are not different worlds, right? For Adams, he experienced it all as one world, and I think that what Tocqueville's observation that every American is a sort of practical Cartesian, I think Adams in some ways cuts against that, right? And I think that the world would be better if there were more people who are educated like John Quincy Adams.
Fascinating reflections on the life, thought, and legacy of John Quincy Adams. Michael Lucchese has written a wonderful review of this Library of America collection of Adams' writings. Let me encourage everyone to take a look at that. Of course, let me take a look at Law and Liberty, the wonderful site. Michael Lucchese, thanks for taking the time to join us on the American
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.